Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Coaching Call podcast. On this podcast, we'll cover various types of coaching by trainers in sports, martial arts, fitness, and business. We'll discuss each coach's methods to getting the most out of their respective athletes or clients and how they attempt to change the platform in which they coach. Join us on a fun adventure as we discuss unique coaching styles. Coaching is a universal part of how we get others to get something done. Join your host, Rafael, and his guests on this unique journey in coaching.
Hi, I'm Sifu Rafael, and this is the Coaching Call podcast. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. This episode was made possible by listeners like you. Vic, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you, my friend?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So you were, a police officer in New York City, and you probably have 1,000, maybe 100,000 stories to tell, right?
Yeah, I had a wonderful 20-year career with the New York City Police Department as a police officer for my first 10 and my last 10 as a detective working in organized crime.
Wow. Cool deal. But before we go there, because we are going to talk about some stories, I am very interested. Let's go back into what neighborhood did you grow up? Who influenced you and what made you even decide to go into the police department?
I grew up in a lower middle class family in the Throgs Neck section of the Bronx. Yeah. I often tell the story. There were three ways you could go. Civil service, which was most of us. Some went to college, and then there were those who went and got involved in organized crime. Mafia was alive and well back then. Something like you'd see in The Sopranos, guys hanging around in front of storefronts, you know, sunning themselves, not really working. And a lot of guys gravitated to that. That wasn't for me. As far as a role model, my dad was a butcher. He got up very early every morning, got up 4:30 every morning, was at work, came through that door at home at 5 o'clock every night. I had a great childhood as far as friends and family, and my dad always instilled in me hard work was the way to go as far as getting anything you wanted in life. He said, always do the work first. Everything else will follow.
That's awesome. Yeah, that is the truth. You do the hard work and then you reap the benefits, right? So your dad obviously sounds like somebody that you wanted to be like, right?
Oh, absolutely. He had
that great work ethic, getting up at 4:30, you know, and definitely showing you. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have one younger brother who followed me into the police department a couple of years after I had entered.
Okay. So let's talk about, besides your dad, who would you say influenced you? And I know the Throgs Neck area because I had a lot of friends over there. So I used to go over the Throgs Neck Bridge and go over there, Sandpoint, you know, some of those areas. And I used to hang out over there with a lot of friends. Great restaurants over there, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I know the area. And when we think about our influences, right, the people who influenced us, who would you say besides your dad, would you say influenced you?
Well, early on, when I was in eighth grade, my dad said to me, he goes, next year you're going to Catholic high school. I went to public school my first 8 years, and I wanted nothing to do with Catholic high school. I mean, we were Catholic, but we didn't attend mass. And my dad said, you're a clown. And if you go to public school, you're going to become a bigger clown. So pick a school run by the men in black. And I did. I went to a Catholic high school. And I wouldn't just say it was one person, but the influence of Catholic school, I mean, the impression it made on me, it was something I didn't want to go kicking and screaming. It was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. As far as the mentors I had, and these people really cared. I have the brothers, the Christian brothers that were there, and the lay people that worked there. They all, I mean, play different roles in my life, but keeping me on the straight and narrow.
Nice. So would you say that definitely, what do you think your life would have been like if you didn't go to if you did go to public school and didn't go to Catholic school?
It probably would have cut in half my chances of becoming a New York City police officer. I know myself, You know what I mean? I'm not blaming that on my neighborhood or the people I was around, but, you know, left to my own devices, I probably wouldn't have gone into law enforcement. I would have gotten sidetracked doing something else.
Gotcha.
It probably wouldn't have been good.
Gotcha. So what was that deciding factor for you? And you said we all have choices, right? You could have gone in organized crime. Listen, I lived in Queens. So I lived in Rego Park. Rego Park it was very saturated. One of my exes, ex-boyfriend was in one of the families and he was a big shot in it. And she told me stories about when they used to go out. She wasn't even in the family, but she was guarded, mm-hmm. and all the different things that they went through. So I can only imagine. But so I grew up with a lot of people who, you're right, they could have gone in that direction or in a different direction. So what prompted you to truly say, I want to be a police officer?
Oh, well, that the die was cast for that when I was a little boy. I mean, at 5, 6 years old, my mother would take me to matinees and the police station was around the corner from the movie theater. So I was fascinated with the police cars and the patrolmen walking in and out of the building.
Nice.
And then I like to tell a story. By age 10, my friends and I used to sneak into the local post office and steal the FBI wanted posters off the wall and then go around the neighborhood and have manhunts. You know, we did. And, you know, that's all I wanted to do was become a New York City police officer or detective. And my parents were like, you got to keep your options open. You got to go to school. And my dad wanted me to go into the trades. Right. And I knew what I wanted to do. I mean, from very early on. But the deciding factor was, I think it was in junior year of high school, I was screwing up, was not getting along with this teacher. And at a parents' conference teachers' night, you know, he asked for my dad, which was a big deal. And for my dad to get up and go to parent teacher's night after working in a meat freezer all day was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And he met with the guy and he came out of the classroom. He just looked at me and just walked to the car. And I'm like, is he going to leave me here? He didn't say a word. And we got in the car and I'm like, what's going to happen now? You know, and he pulled over to the side and he goes, I don't want to use the language, but he didn't like the teacher either. And he goes, look, he's not my kind of guy either. He goes, but the reality is, he says, he holds the key to you getting out of this high school. He goes, if you want to become a New York City police officer, he goes, you have to graduate. Mm. I said, well, Dad, I'm probably going to fail this class. He goes, then you're going to go to summer school. He goes, and you're going to make up the work and maybe you'll get a teacher next year that'll be better. He says, but there's all things in life that we have to do that we don't want to do to get what we want. He says that you have to pass. You have to graduate with a high school diploma if you want to become a police officer. Mm. And that resonated with me. And I had a lot of respect for my dad. And, you know, if you're close with your parents, you don't want to disappoint them.
Right.
And that was just an added thing on my shoulders that, you know what I mean? I didn't want to disappoint him.
Wow. I got to tell you, my God, your dad was true sage for you. What great words of wisdom he gave you. Right. That you have to do the things even if you don't want to, right?
He wasn't a philosophical guy at all. He was pretty much to the point. I mean, there's more to it in one of my books. And again, I don't want to use the language he used, but it's, he got to the point. You know what I mean? He was a no-nonsense. He was funny, but he was when it came down to, you know, his children and right and wrong, I mean, there was a fine line with my dad. And if you crossed it, there would be consequences. I mean, nowadays, people would say, oh, you know, my dad didn't beat my brother and I. But I mean, if we stepped out of line, we get a crack.
Right. Yeah, I hear you. So you knew you wanted to be a police officer. You were going for it. And even your dad said, if you want to be a police officer, you have to graduate. So at what age did you go and take your just apply?
So in New York, there was this York, there's a trade newspaper, The Chief.
Mm-hmm.
And The Chief would post when civil service exams came up. And I think I was about late, probably almost 20.
Mm.
I took the test. I passed. I got a list number. And, you know, my father says, great. He goes, now you got a list number. He goes, now all you have to do is stay out of trouble. he goes, stay out of trouble. And there was a kid that lived two doors down from us. And he basically raised himself. And he started getting into drugs and getting arrested. My father was like, stay away from him. He goes, hello and goodbye. He goes, don't get in a car with this kid. Don't hang around with this kid. He goes, because someone's going to throw a garbage can off a roof. He's going to move and you're going to get hit with it. And it was the best advice anybody had ever, because this kid later went on to prison and then, you know, in and out of drug rehab and died at an early age. But yeah, by 21, I was in the police academy after passing the exam and going through the background check and the screening and the health exams, et cetera.
How was the academy back then? Because I'm sure it's a little different today. I have somebody in the family who, believe it or not, they went through the New York City Academy, and then they decided they went to the, because of all the politics that are going on now, they got so fed up. They're like, we can't even arrest anybody. It's like we arrest them and then we got to let them go, even if they're a criminal. And so he got fed up, and now he's in the Suffolk Academy. He actually, they didn't give him credit for being in the Academy in New York. No. He had to go entirely through the, right now he's in the middle of the Academy. So, but he goes, it's a whole different world.
Yeah. I didn't have any military background. I was just a kid at a Catholic high school that goes into the police academy. So I really didn't know what to expect. I had a good friend of mine who was a couple months older than me that went into the academy the year before. So I knew somewhat to expect. But until you experience it, it wasn't that tough. It really wasn't. Like, I was in good shape. I wasn't a Navy SEAL. You know what I mean? When I went in there, I didn't find the physical part too difficult. I wasn't a fan of the police academy, and it wasn't because they try to break you down and build you up. What I found ironic about it was most of the police academy instructors were only a couple of years older than me. And then you say to yourself, well, how much street time did they do? And they're telling us all this stuff. And this guy's 25 years old. Like, he went through the same thing I did, and he's only 24, 25 years old. And he's yelling at you and barking at you. What's going to happen to you in the street if this happens and that happens? And the funny thing is, all they told us in the police academy was, don't listen. And in the NYPD, you call like an old timer or a hairbag. Don't listen to those hairbags, what they're going to tell you. Don't listen to the police academy. That's all nonsense. You're going to get in trouble. The second we go into field training and we get assigned to a precinct, they say, forget everything you learned in the police academy. So it was funny. I mean, what made it bearable were my classmates. Like, the New York City Police Department hires, I mean, a small police academy class in my day was like 250. And I think they had classes with over 2,500. So we hire in bulk. I was in a mid-level class. I was in a class of 1,200. And then they break you down into companies of 30. Right. So it was my classmates that made the experience bearable. But I just found it was ironic. It the academy left a bad taste in my mouth. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, well. Well, but it didn't stop you from continuing, right? Because do people quit? Because my brother was in the Marines. And people quit halfway through. I mean, they quit both mentally and physically, because some of them actually committed suicide, which is a shame. Because they could not handle that. In the Marines, it was way really, I mean, think about the grueling aspects. And when you're in the police academy, you get to go home every night, right?
Right.
But when you're in the military, you don't do that. You're there day in, day out. So it is different. But for me, when I look at a police officer, without a doubt, I have a ton of respect and thank you for serving. But also it makes me think of police officers are not getting paid enough for the fact that the minute they put on the uniform, they're a target, right?
Oh, definitely. And it's funny that you said you had a relative that went to Nassau in Suffolk County, because I remember in my police academy class, and like my company of 30 or 27 or whatever it was, that's all you heard. The guys from Long Island were saying, we took this job to get the experience, but the second Nassau or Suffolk County calls, we're out of here. Right. I mean, we probably lost out of my, you know, class of 27, probably 8 or 10 people that went to Nassau and Suffolk County, because they paid more and it wasn't the same stress level. that you were going to experience, you know, when you get dumped off in a New York City precinct.
Yeah. Yeah. So you got a training officer, right? What was your first day like wearing the blue uniform?
Well, you don't
recall that day.
Oh yeah. You don't get it. Well, in my time, it's different. In my time, when you graduated the police academy, you went to field training, and the Bronx had 12 precincts. So they had three FTUs. Each FTU had about 50 rookie cops in it, and you covered three precincts. Yeah, three precincts. So I was in FTU 7 in the South Bronx. There were three sergeants in charge of like the 50 of us, but you weren't in a car every day. So the first day, they, you know, gave, it was like a half day of orientation, and they gave you a foot post and said, go take public transportation, go find it, you know, get a map, find where your post is in the precinct, and we'll come out there at some point and give you a scratch, which means we'll just check on you and sign your memo book. And I remember I was on, I remember I was off of Fulton Avenue off the Cross Bronx Expressway, and it was all abandoned buildings, buildings. It looked like Berlin after World War II. And I mean, we're in the middle of the crack epidemic, and there's crackheads walking around with stuff they stole, and I'm looking in abandoned buildings, and people are coming up to me and speaking to me in Spanish. And I took remedial Spanish, I think, in freshman year.
Right.
I'd long forgotten it. And, people are coming to me with their problems. And I'm like, it was overwhelming, like the first couple of days on foot. But I wasn't going to quit over it. There's a lot of things you have to learn. You have to have an ear for the radio. You got to know your surroundings. And if there's a call on your radio, you got to know, hey, something's coming my way, or I got to pick up that call. Because if a radio call goes there and says, hey, kid, didn't you hear that on the radio? That's your job. So you really had to get a finely tuned ear for the radio. And you had to know the difference between when someone was coming to you with nonsense or with something serious. So there was a lot to digest. And then every now and then they'd put you in a call with a sergeant, and it would be two rookie cops and a sergeant. And then you would go out and answer calls, and they would give you the worst calls.
Of course,
because you're going to experience this down the road. So a lot of it was responding to DOAs. An elderly person had died in their apartment the week before. You know, they're in there decomposing, and you've got to go in there and call the medical examiner, call the detectives. You got to put on latex gloves. You got to search them for identification. I mean, just these terrible things I had to do, but it's part of life, and it's part of police work. And, you know, you get a real taste for it.
Yeah. You know, I was privy. I was dating a girl, and her sister was dating a police officer. And funniest guy ever, he had, this is before cell phones, right? So he had two albums. This is the crazy part. One album was You're Not Gonna Believe This. And he had those little cameras that he would actually take pictures of crime scenes. And he would make believe he was sneezing to take the picture, because you heard it, click, click. And then he had an album. And when you flip through these, oh my God, the images that we can see in this album were beyond people decomposing, you know, people like jumped out of a window and got caught because he was in Harlem, and people that got caught on the
impaled.
Yeah. They got impaled, but on the window of adjacent. Right. And it was, but they were naked, and it was like, why would you jump out naked? And it was all kinds of crazy images like that. And it was, and then he goes, and this is a normal album. And then he'd just take people like, you know, doing different things. But I was said, how did you get away with even taking these images? He goes, well, then he told me about, he used to make believe he sneezed, and that's when he would take a picture, and he kept that camera in his pocket.
Every precinct had a guy or a girl like that.
Yeah,
that would, they'd hear there's a DOA or bad car accident. And this is before digital cameras.
Right.
I mean, they'd have a camera, and they, you know, take photos, and, you know, it was like, I always thought it was like a ghoulish thing. And your friend's sister's boyfriend, he's not the first one that did that.
Oh yeah.
Of course. I mean, there was a couple of people, there was a guy or girl in every precinct that did that. the cops that worked in Midtown, a lot of them carried cameras because they were always bumping into famous people. And I knew a couple of people, like they had photo albums. I mean, I have photos with famous people I met over the years, but nothing like these people. I mean, it's like if you go into the Carnegie Deli and there's like 200 photos of Broadway stage and actors and that with their autographs. It's funny you're talking about like the crazy violent deaths. Just before I retired, I recovered a car, a stolen car in the 28, which is Harlem, which in the 70s was called the deadliest square mile in America because the precinct was a square mile and they had something like 120 homicides in the square mile. Yeah. People forget that New York City used to average over 2,500 homicides a year. And I'm doing paperwork and I'm up in their detective squad and I found the old homicide log from the 70s. And I was like, I felt like Indiana Jones discovering because for me, growing up, hearing about Randy Jurgensen and Sonny Grasso, they worked in this the famous detectives that did the French Connection case. And I'm going through this homicide log from the 70s, and there's hundreds of homicides and the causes of death. I mean, most were gunshot, but then people got creative. There was a couple where a woman poured a pot of boiling hot water on over her husband's head as he slept on the couch. Boiling hot oil killed her husband. Cue balls, cue sticks. And I'm just reading them. I'm like, wow. I mean, I thought New York City was violent when I got hired, but the 70s was a totally different ball of wax.
Well, Mandy, who joined us, hey, Mandy, how are you? She says she would love to read your books. So, and I know you've written four. Would you mind telling us, give us some of your titles, tell us about where we can get some of your books? And you know I'm going to want a signed copy, right?
Absolutely. I've actually written six books, but four about the New York City Police Department. So my first one is NYPD Through the Looking Glass, Stories from Inside America's Largest Police Department. Nice. That's a behind-the-scenes look into the NYPD that most people would never think about what's going on behind the scenes. Grand Theft Auto, the NYPD's Auto Crime Division. That's everything about the stolen car industry in my 10 years working in the NYPD's Auto Crime Division.
It kind of makes sense that you worked in that because your last name is Ferrari. Come on.
That's my pen name. And I picked that name because if you remember the television show Taxi, when Latka, the mild-mannered auto mechanic, would suffer a blow to the head, he'd become this suave and debonair guy, Vic Ferrari. So that's where I got the name from.
Oh, okay. That's your pen name. Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. You know, it's funny. You mentioned Latka. His daughter was one of my clients.
She wrote a book.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So interesting, right?
That's cool.
Yeah. So go ahead. Keep telling me about your books.
Oh, sure. NYPD Law and Disorder. It's got a picture of a prisoner escaping out of the backseat of a car. That's happened. Not to me, thank God, but it's happened. I don't have the other ones in front of me. The NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos. That's loaded with wild stories. And Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate, which is about me growing up in the Bronx, getting in trouble and turning my life around. Actually, it's got a picture of a kid running out of a confession booth, getting chased by a priest. That actually happened to me. I wasn't abused or anything, but when you confess one sin too many, it can lead to a foot chase to an empty church.
So, wow, amazing. And like I said, I knew you had tons of stories. I thought you only wrote four books. So congratulations on writing six. And I'm sure you could probably write more, right? I love all the covers, by the way. They're really cool, clever.
It's a company I use. They're up in Canada. And what I do is they want the title and they want you to give them an idea of what you want. So like with Grand Theft Auto, I explained, I want a picture of a couple of guys stripping a car in front of an abandoned building and stacking parts next to the car. And they got it. I mean, I've never had a problem with this company. They always hit the ball out of the park.
Nice. Yeah. So Mandy's here with us and she says, good for you. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mandy.
Yeah. So what, you know, you 10 years in each division, right? And then you became a detective. Was that a goal all along? Or was that a goal that once you got into the academy, you go, I want to go to that division?
Oh, no, I always wanted to be a detective. Always. And I bounced around a lot. I mean, early in my career, I worked at a couple of South Bronx precincts. And Like, if you ever saw the movie Fort Apache, the Bronx?
Yes.
Paul Newman. Okay, so that movie was about the old 4-1 precinct. Mm. By the time I got to the South Bronx, they called the 4-1 Little House on the Prairie because really? It was all burned out. Yeah. But they filmed the movie in the 4-2 precinct, which is the sister precinct right next door. That's where I was assigned, where you see Paul Newman yelling out the window, let the brothers go, and the riot mm-hmm. scene. That was my old precinct. Huh. And when I got there, you know, it was mid-80s, middle of the crack epidemic, and the 4-2 was somewhat of a dumping ground. So either somebody like the rookies went there if you didn't know anybody, you're right. Mm-hmm. My dad wasn't a captain or an inspector, so I was just backfill. You had a lot of guys that had returned from Vietnam. Mm. They were a different kind of cat. And then you had guys that had screwed up in other places, and they were dumped there. And very early on, I said, there is no way, as much as there was action there, there was no place to eat. It was very depressing. And I said, you know what? I got to get out of here. So I bounced around a lot. I worked in the NYPD's narcotics division in Manhattan North in the early 90s when Giuliani started beefing up the narcotics divisions. Mm-hmm. They did that for about a year and a half. But I was always a car guy. Like growing up in Frog's Neck, there was so many car thieves. And I worked in a gas station. And they were always rolling through with stolen cars, with broken ignitions and punched out door locks. So I was always getting into car chases because I knew what to look for.
Right.
And I had so many car arrests, and I was somewhat of an expert at the time before I went to the auto crime division in confidential vehicle identification numbers on cars. So when they steal a car and they change the VIN number for resale, and, you know, I did 10 years in the auto crime division. I loved every minute of it.
Mm.
But I'm sorry, to answer your question, yes, I always wanted to be a detective.
You did. So what – because there's different categories of being a detective. Which one did you go into?
Well, I was working in organized crime. So there's different types of detectives. So most people, you know, if you watch the television show Barney Miller.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, you got 77 precincts scattered across New York City. And upstairs in every NYPD precinct, you have a PDU, a precinct detective unit. And there's usually, depending on the size of the precinct, between 5 and 20 detectives. And they're catching everything. Bounce checks, domestic violence, fraud, extortion. And they're overworked and underpaid. I mean, those guys really, really, they work them to death. Then you have the Organized Crime Control Division, OCCB. And under the OCC umbrella at the time was the Auto Crime Division, Narcotics, Vice, OCID, which targeted the five families on a different level than we did. There were a lot, El Dorado, which was the money laundering unit. There's a lot of units that were under OCCB. So we weren't catching cases. We were more proactive. So in the auto crime division, our mission was to stop auto theft and cut the head off. Mm. Because at the time, New York City was averaging 150,000 stolen cars a year.
Wow.
So you could just run around and run plates and come up with stolen cars. They wanted us to go after the chop shops, the salvage yards, the guys exporting the cars out of the country.
And probably that was very big to export them out, right?
Oh, yeah. And different ethnic groups were involved at different levels. Like we did a case with Asians. They were shipping 30 stolen Audi A6s a month to Shanghai. Wow. We had a case with a guy that was shipping a couple of cars a month to Antigua, Jamaica. Dominican Republic was used. There was so many guys shipping stolen vehicles to the Dominican Republic. We used to say we didn't know how the island didn't sink with the amount of cars they were shipping out of Newark.
Really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. It wasn't just cars. It was heavy equipment. Like you drive past a construction site, you see those Bobcats.
Right.
They'd steal those. The Ingersoll Ram compressors, those big lights that you see light up a construction site at night when they're doing road work, jackhammers, you name it. If it can bring them money overseas, they're going to steal it.
Oh, yeah. I was working at a site because I do finish carpentry. And I was working at a site and there was cameras everywhere. But somehow... copper wire, and it was a huge reel that and they caught the guys. They lived behind the compound that we were, it was this building that we were doing, and they lived right behind it. I'm like, guys, couldn't you have stolen from somewhere further away a little bit? I guess it was convenient for them, but they were caught on camera. So,
and it was too big to pass up.
Yeah.
They probably knew the price of copper. And, like the same thing nowadays. I mean, that wasn't big when I was a cop, but now with those catalytic converters, because metals in there, it's going to a scrap metal processor. I mean, all you got to really do is hang out by the scrap metal processor. And it's funny. Sometimes we would do that. There was one in the Bronx. There were a couple in the Bronx, actually. And body shops and guys that are chopping cars in back of their house in a garage or something, right?
Right.
They get the parts. The parts go wherever. But now we call it the bones when they've got the shell of the car. So they'll cut the car up in sections like the cowl and everything. Right. And then there's usually a bones truck. It's usually a guy that goes around with a van or a box truck, and they'll load all that crap in, and then they'll take it to a scrap metal processor. And, those were difficult to catch if it's in a box truck or something and they go into the scrap. But some of them would put it on the back of a flatbed. So you're driving by and you see like three different cars chopped up in sections and they look newer. You might want to talk to that young man. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, exactly. where did this come from?
Yeah, very interesting. And, so many, I'm sure that you came up against so many different creative ideas of people trying to get away with murder and mayhem, right?
Oh yeah, the scams. It was funny. Like, you never knew what you were going to get. I mean, I had one case where we had it would be too long to tell, but long story short, I had a diplomat with a stolen car. The car was stolen in France, shipped to the United States from Africa. And the husband was an international dirtbag of the diplomat. And they were driving around in the stolen Mercedes. And I had to work with the State Department and Mercedes-Benz and a detective that was assigned in France to get this car back. Another time I had a case, the director of security from BMW called me up. There was a guy, and his scam was, he lived in New Jersey in this high rise. He would go into the garage of his building. He would write down VIN numbers of BMWs. Then what he would do is he would get a phony title made under his name to that car. Then he would go across the river to Manhattan and say, yeah, I'm a car dealer. I bought this car at auction. I don't have the keys. And he had a title. It was a bogus title, but it had his name on it that matched his driver's license. And in, a week, they would cut him a key. He'd go back to his garage, go downstairs, steal the BMW and ship it or chop it. He was getting away with this for probably about a year. And I got a call because the way he got caught was one of the cars he came in to steal, the guy was getting an oil change. And they were like, no, hold on a second. Why is he requesting a key for a car of another customer and the car is here getting an oil change? So they told us, I told them, yeah, tell him you're going to make the key. And then my partner and I dressed up like we work there. And when the guy came in to pick up his key a couple of days later, he paid us for the key.
Right.
I took the key and I says, I got something for you. You're our 100th customer today. And I came from behind the counter and we locked him up. And then we're going through his pockets. And what do we find? Titles for cars for Mercedes and Land Rover. So then we went over to Mercedes and Land Rover. We put about 5 or 10 cars on. I forget. This is 20 something years ago. Wow. And he did time for it.
Yeah, well, obviously. But clever in a way, right?
He wouldn't have gotten caught. He just kept going to the same place and it just happened. He just got caught.
Yeah. Well, that's crazy. That's crazy. But you know what? Here's the old saying, right? When there's a will, there's a way.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And if you're a criminal, you'll find a way.
They're intelligent people. They just don't want to work 9-to-5 jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or pay taxes.
That's correct. That's because you're not going to pay on stolen goods, right? You're not going to pay your taxes on them.
No, and you're your own boss, right? I mean, unless you're in the mob. And, they wake up late, go to bed late. It's funny. You learn so much about these people. We would go up on wiretaps sometimes. And it was just funny because you'd see the human aspect of them talking to their kids or their wife or something. But then, you saw like when it got down to business, some of these guys were, they were hard work. If they put their effort and drive into something legitimate, they probably could have been very successful.
Right.
But for whatever reason, they just wanted to go into criminal activity.
It's a very interesting. I was a bouncer for 5 years in Manhattan, like the Palladium, if you remember that.
You might know some of the same people.
Possible. And, it happened the last nightclub I worked for, and that I decided, I'm not going to work in these things anymore. But I was one of the few bouncers that the police never came looking for, because I never hurt one person, because I know martial arts. So I was like, you know, I just need to flip them around and tell them and whisper in their ear, do you want to go home or you want to go to jail? So for the most part, they're like, who is this crazy guy? You know, usually bouncers are beating on them if they do something wrong. And the last one I worked at was, believe it or not, was called the Lemon Tree in Forest Hills. It was in a basement. You remember Forest Hills?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I was in there once many years ago. Yeah,
remember there was lemon, there was trees, yes. There was lemons, and the place was always packed. So I was a bouncer there, and on the last, this is when that place finally closed down. So that morning there was some drug dealer. They put a hit on him, and they tried to take him out on the George Washington Bridge, and they failed. And this guy was not that bright, because that evening he went out to a nightclub. Think about it. Somebody tries to kill you in the morning or in the afternoon, whatever time it was. And then you say, I'm going to go out. So
you got to lay low.
Yeah. So he went to 5 different clubs, and each club they had crews waiting for him. And he went to Lemon Tree. When he got out, he got in his Mercedes. He was with his girlfriend and another couple. And they were right outside. I had been at the front door. I went down for a little bit, came back up. 8 guys in motorcycles came, shot up the car, and took down the block. Down the block from Lemon Tree was the police station. I think it was 75th Street Police.
Was that the 112?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. You're right. The 112. And so the guys went around. You have Continental. They went around. And they got all of them, because the cops were like, whoa, what happened? They caught them on the around the block. And when I went around the block, they had them all laid down on the floor. These guys were on motorcycles. I don't know how they caught them. And they had them all on the floor. All of a sudden, they're on the floor. And you hear beep, 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 beep. And then all the beepers started going. And then the police officers go, oh, look at that. What do we got here? And so that's how they caught some of the other people.
Well, that's probably the guy that ordered the hit.
Yeah.
Wanted to know, how did it go?
Yeah. Did it happen? Did you guys catch him? Right. Yeah. So, I mean, crazy, crazy things that people do, like even putting out hits and just organized crime and gangs and all these different things.
Oh, some of our gangs were doing, one of the cases we were doing where the cars were getting shipped to China, Shanghai. We quickly figured out, once we went on those wiretaps, that our thieves, I mean, and they were prolific car thieves, they were in the murder for hire business.
Mm.
And they were bragging about it and talking about it. And, you know, this guy better watch it. He's going to wind up like this guy. And we took that case down, which originally started off with shipping vehicles out of the country. Our thieves would probably solve between 13 and 15 homicides.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. So what inspired you? Because you were in the police academy, you ran across probably hundreds of cops in your time. What inspired you to write a book?
Boredom.
No way. Really?
Yeah. I retired from the NYPD. I moved down to Florida. I got a job with a local police department, and it wasn't for me. Great department, but just wasn't for me. Mm. Law enforcement in Florida is just totally different, coming from the, you know, America's largest police department investigating organized crime. Now I'm on the road doing DUIs and domestics. We retired. And friends and family, you know, you got all these funny stories and all these unbelievable stories. Why don't you write a book? Mm. And I didn't think I could do it. And B, I was afraid of blowback. But then I said, you know what? If I do this, I'm gonna do my best not to get anybody in trouble,
right?
Or divorced. And I change. Yeah, I'm not a sour. I had a great career. I'm not looking to out somebody. Were there people I didn't like that I write about my books? Absolutely. But I changed the names, the dates, the locations. You know what I mean? I'm not looking to hurt anybody. But my books give you a behind-the-scenes look of the crazy things that happened during my time with the New York City Police Department.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible. Incredible that the fact is that you did the right thing, right? For, I guess, your brothers in blue, if you will, that you didn't get them divorced, if you will. And when I think about, you said that reminded me of my ex whose boyfriend was in the mob. And she said, because he wasn't married, she would see the boyfriend, the girlfriends and the wives. So she would sit at dinner one night with the girlfriends and the other night with the wives.
Sounds like
and
good it was the
funniest. Yeah. She said this was normal. So she said to him, and she said to him, is that going to be me if I marry you? You're going to have a girlfriend that at a certain night that you go out with? And he goes, oh, no. And she goes, yeah, no, that's why she left him, because she wanted to be with one person, not, you know, right, not have that happen to her. But it's interesting when you say you don't want to get anybody in trouble or divorced.
Yeah, well, when I started writing these books, probably about 7 years ago, I still had a couple of friends that were active. I think the last one just retired about a year ago. So I wouldn't know anybody on the job anymore.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. So what privileges would you say that, and I don't want to come off in a negative way, but what privileges do you say, or would you say that some police officers think that they are above?
I wouldn't say what you're above. I call it, it's funny, in one of my books I wrote, once I retired from the NYPD and moved to Florida, I lost my superpowers. So, and a lot of people aren't going to want to hear this, but right, it's the truth. In my time, I don't know what goes on now. In my time, if one NYPD member pulled over another NYPD member for a traffic infraction, you had your ID card, you weren't drunk out of your mind, and you were nice, you're not getting a ticket. Now, people don't want to hear that. They'll say, well, that's not fair, or blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, maybe it's not. But if your sister worked for American Airlines or your mother worked for the Yankees, chances are you were going to fly for free on a buddy pass and you were going to get free tickets to a Yankee game.
Right.
So membership had its privileges as far as traffic infractions went. You know, you got into a car accident. You were able to get, you didn't have to go through the nonsense of getting your accident report like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of perks with it. I mean, as a cop, I worked so many, I'm a big sports fan. I mean, I was lucky enough. I worked all the World Series and playoff games,
You know, with
Yankees and Mets. It was great. You know, so there definitely were perks that people wouldn't really associate with police work.
Right. But sometimes you also had to put in the times when, instead of being with family, you had to work, right?
Oh, yeah. I worked 17 out of 20 years at Times Square on New Year's Eve.
Mm.
You know, 4th of July's, I was either in Coney Island or Orchard Beach, you know, looking for lost children at the beach. Yeah, people don't realize that you work the holidays and, you know, even when seniority, I mean, they didn't care if something was going on or, you know, there were a lot of hours and a lot of times like, I just want to go home and like, nope. We got to send you. There's a strike, you know, or a large scale demonstration. I mean, right, you know, just things come up and you're at the needs of the department.
What was the craziest story you can tell us from Times Square New Year's Eve?
It's a miserable time. And I encourage your listeners.
I've never been. And you know how many friends of mine go, oh, we're going. You want to come? I'm like, absolutely not.
Okay, so this is how it works for us. We get down there. Cops get down there probably about 3-4 o'clock, and then they break. They line everybody up, thousands of us, and they break us down into groups of eight. And it's one cop per sergeant. Each lieutenant has probably 24 underneath them, and he's oversaw by a captain. So there's a lot of brass. It's like a flow chart.
Yeah.
And it's cold and they want you out there. There's no hiding. There's no disappearing. Mm. They want you out there. You're dealing with drunks all night. And when you see those people from above all packed in nice, they're like cattle. There's wooden barriers and they're packed in there. All those restaurants, unless you have reservations, you're not going to get to use the bathroom. We got to use the bathroom, but those poor people in there could not use the bathroom. So what happens in that crowd? People are going to the bathroom in the crowd. They're throwing up on each other in the crowd. People are getting felt up in the crowd. People are getting robbed in the crowd. So it's just miserable. I think the worst year I ever worked was the year 2000, because you had a lot of people that thought that once the clock struck 12, the world was coming to an end. Remember Y2K? And you had there were religious people down there with bullhorns. There were anarchists. I mean, that was the craziest New Year's Eve I can remember. And once that ball drops, all hell breaks loose. People are throwing stuff and spraying stuff.
Really?
And then what happens is, after sanitation comes by and they're breaking down the barriers, you get all the hood rats that are sober as judges. They come up from the Bronx and Manhattan and Brooklyn, and they're hanging out and they're watching who's drunk, who's got a new iPhone, who's flashing cash, and they follow them. They know they're going to have to take the train or go to the West Side look for their car, and people start getting robbed like crazy, and people are drunk and they're coming up to you, you know, all banged up, and they're like, I just got robbed 3 blocks from here. And it's like, well, good luck finding them in a crowd of a couple of million people.
Right.
So it's I wouldn't go down there unless I had to.
Yeah. I've had one of my clients every year used to go, and he's like, hey, you coming? I'm like, no, not at all. I said, you have fun. I said, but and now I can only imagine it's even worse, because first the pandemic, right, hit everybody in a different way. And then now, because of, you know, you can't even bring a bag. You can't bring anything. So,
oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can't bring it like a duffel bag or anything. So you can't bring anything. So you can't even bring like a sandwich, I mean, or a drink, right? So imagine you're sitting out there for hours and hours on end, and now you are sardined. Now what? What are you doing? And like you said, you can't go to the bathroom. Where right. do you go?
In the crowd. And you're hearing people screaming in there. And it's just, it's a sea of humanity.
Yeah, it's got to be nuts. It's got to be nuts. Vic, I got to tell you, you know, I'm enjoying this conversation that we're having. What would you say is some of the lessons you've learned that you can share with people so that they can be more vigilant about being out in public?
Always be around of your surroundings. I mean, my NYPD career is ingrained in me, things that I just do now that it's so, for instance, I never enter a store without looking into the store, any place. If there's a glass window, I want to see the people's reaction in the store. I want to see what the people are doing behind the counter. I don't want to walk into a robbery or something like that. I know people, oh, come on, what are the odds? It happens. Go on YouTube. Same as when I'm driving. If you want to protect yourself from a carjacking, so especially if you live in a busy city, when you're at a light or something, don't pull snug up on the back bumper of somebody. Give yourself a couple of feet that if you gotta maneuver. If you're pinned, I mean, that's the way we used to catch car thieves. We'd wait till they got boxed in traffic and just carjack them, pull them out of the stolen car. Well, they're going to do the same thing. So give yourself a couple of feet. If someone starts banging on your window or tries to pull you out of the car, you can go right or left that you're not pinned. Be just vigilant of your surroundings. You know, if someone's banging on your door and you don't know them, don't open the door. Good people that follow rules are compelled to just do things that often put themselves in harm's way. You know who doesn't get hurt doing that? Bad guys don't hurt other bad guys a lot of times because they know better. You know, don't open the door if you don't know somebody. Invest in a Ring doorbell. It's $100. You can see who it is. There's a lot of things you can do. Just to, any day above ground is a good day, and do your best, you know, to protect yourself.
That's great words of advice. You know, it's very funny because even though I'm not in the military, I was never a police officer. It's funny, the things that you talked about, I do. It's for some reason, I have that instinct.
Well, you're a bouncer, so you could have gotten hurt very easily.
Oh my God!
You know, you talk about, and especially in those clubs, you've definitely got a criminal and a dirtbag element that goes through there, and they're drinking, they're doing drugs. There's women involved, so you got the ego. Their friends are there, so I mean, you get hurt real quick in those clubs. And I'm sure you know friends that were shot or stabbed or beat up. You know what I mean? So you've had a taste of, this could go really wrong for me, and it stays with you.
No, it's fast too. It's a split second.
People have no idea.
Yeah. It's interesting because even now when I drive, I always leave a full car length, even at a light. And people are like, why are you back here? Why don't you pull up? And I'm like, in case I have to leave, what do you do? What are you talking about? I'm like, you never know. Oh, you're crazy. I'm like, it's okay. Call me crazy, but I think you should do it too. And so now if I'm ever a passenger and I see somebody who's always bumping into, you know, like, I'm like, hey, why don't you back up a little bit? Give them some room. They're like, oh, you know, I said, you know what? If you don't value your life, I value mine. So drop me off. I don't want to be driven by you and get killed, because not only that, you know, if you're tailgating, you know, I mean, not tailgating like a football game, but like if you're right on somebody's butt and they stop short, we're going to be in their back seat. So I don't want that either. And then the other thing is, it's very interesting. Whenever I go to a restaurant, somebody, like my girlfriend, always says to me, I know where you're sitting. I'm like, yeah, that's right. That's right. Always looking at the door. And if for some strange reason, if I'm meeting someone and they're there before me, I want to make sure that there's a mirror I can look, right? So,
and you want your back to the wall so no one can get in back of you.
Yeah, yeah.
Watch any cop in a bus station or an airport or a public place. Their back is against the wall.
Yeah, especially train station.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because unfortunately, so many people get pushed even by accident because they're looking for the train. It's going to come. You know, if you look, it's not going to get there any sooner, right?
What's that old expression? A watch pot never boils.
That's right. They all boil eventually, but you got to just chill. That's why, you know what? That's why, like tea kettles, right? That's why they have the little whistle. So you don't have to worry about it.
You'll hear the train. You don't want to see it.
You may not see it. What's one of the lessons that you realize now that you wish you would learned sooner?
Oh, I wish I could, right off the top of my head, I wish I knew how to play the game better politically. I was always under the mindset, and I got that from my father, just do the work, keep your nose down and do the work. I was not a schmoozer, unfortunately. I didn't join a lot of the fraternal organizations. I didn't rub elbows. I didn't glad hand. And probably had I done that, I would have gotten promoted. You know, in detectives is third grade, second grade, first grade. And I was always considered to be promoted. I was always put in to be promoted, but I didn't play the game. You know what I mean? I was too busy working. I didn't have time to join the fraternal organizations and make contacts. And the guys and girls that did, they went up the ladder. But I have no regrets. But if you ask me if I could go back and change something, I probably would have done a little bit of that. But overall, I'm happy the way things turned out.
Good for you. Good for you. So you wrote your first book because your family said, hey, you have these funny stories. But you didn't stop there. What made you write the second book? And money. Then the third and then the fourth? Money?
Money, and it's fun. I mean, it's, you know, you write a book, you put it out there, and it starts selling, and then you start getting positive feedback. And it's like, it's cool. It's validation that I spent a year of my life putting this thing together and people like it. And I'm making a little bit of money with it. And then I wrote another one and another one. And now I've got it down to a process where I average about a book a year. If I could probably write two a year, but I'm not going to work myself to death. And I do anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour a day. There's no heavy lifting.
Right.
I know the process. I've got everything in place, you know, editing, two rounds of editing, the book covers, the marketing. I do everything myself.
Nice.
And it's fun. It keeps me busy. It keeps me out of trouble.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes the pen is mightier than the sword, right?
Absolutely. And I always say, now I get to live vicariously through myself. A lot of guys and girls from law enforcement, when they retire, they kind of lose a sense of identity. It's like musical chairs. Now the music stopped, and now I've got to find my place in society. And some people don't handle that well. You know, I mean, some cops, they get addicted to drugs after they retire, or alcoholism, their marriage breaks up because they can't find something that fulfills the excitement or validation. So, you know, I knew I had to find something.
Yeah. Yeah. So why Florida? I mean, why didn't you stay in New York?
Lived in New York for over 40 years. I needed a change of scenery. I was thinking about buying a house in New Jersey. And then I realized New Jersey would have taken 6% of my pension. So I didn't like New Jersey that much. I had friends that I had grown up with that became engineers 30 years before, and they had moved to Florida, working in the aero, you know, defense industry and everything. So after I retired, I called a couple of them up and I said, hey, you mind if I come down and stay for a while? I'm going to look around. I had been coming to Florida for years, vacationing, spring break when I was a kid. So I knew the area, and, you know, I came down, I stayed a little bit. I bought a house, you know, I got that job with the police department down here and, you know, got established. And it's not like I just jumped into Florida blind. And that happens to a lot of people. They come down here and then they realize that you have to drive to things. And like in New York, you just walk out your door. You want Chinese food, it's 10 steps away. You got to get in a car. It's always hot. You know, you got to plan your day differently than in New York.
Right.
But, you know, overall, I'm happy.
Nice. What would you say? You wrote a book about you, right? The other books were about your stories, right? Things you experienced or witnessed, right? If you will. What made you write a book about you personally?
Oh, Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate, about my childhood. Yeah. My younger brother, who I refer to in my books, is Fredo Ferrari, like Fredo Corleone. My brother and I, we get along, but we bust each other's balls.
Right.
My younger brother said, you know, the book to write, he says, is about our childhood. He says, it would be really funny, the things that we got ourselves involved in. And I said, you know, it's not going to sell like the NYPD books, right? I said, yeah. And he just wouldn't. He was relentless. You got to write a book. I said, be careful what you wish for. I says, because you might not like the way you're portrayed in it. And he goes, I don't care. Like, you can't embarrass my brother. And I started writing it. And I was like, you know what? This is fun. It's kind of like I did it for us. And I know if I write an NYPD book, it's going to sell. There's just so many people that like true crime and fascinated with the New York City Police Department, detective stories. So when you write a book out of your genre, it's almost like you're going to see like your favorite artist and they do a new album that you don't really like. And you go to a concert and you're like, why don't they just play the classics? Like, why are they playing this crap? Which is kind of what I did. But I've gotten good feedback about my childhood. So, I mean, it was just that my brother's urging.
Gotcha. So are you planning on writing other books about your experience as a police officer? Or you have two categories, right? You have as a police officer, young you, and then the older you as a detective, because they're probably two different types of stories, right?
Not really. So my books, I can't write in chronological order. I mean, the Catholic High School one, I had to write in chronological order, but I hate writing it. So my books are like this. You pick up one of my books, there's going to be a chapter, say, about police corruption. So in one of my books, there's a chapter called Crossing Over to the Dark Side. And that chapter's got five or six stories about cops I knew that went bad. Or another one of my books is a chapter, Practical Jokers. And it's about the things that go on in the locker room and how cops prank each other. So my books are just short stories about criminal investigations I was involved in, or the funny things, or the characters I worked with, or the politics behind the scenes with the NYPD, or what was going on in the time frame.
Nice. Has any of these true crime podcast people ever reached out to you and say, hey, Vic, we would love to hear about this particular thing that maybe you were involved or you knew about?
Yeah, when you self-publish a book, the only way you're going to the marketing is on you.
Right.
So I do between 5 and 10 radio or podcast interviews a week. Nice. I reach out to them. And sometimes they reach out to me, and yeah, sometimes they'll see me on another YouTube channel or another podcast, or they read something and they're like, hey, now I'm getting contacted from guys on different podcasts about mafia things because I knew some of the characters, so I can fill in things for them. You know what I mean? So it goes both ways. I reach out to people that have forums and they reach out to me.
Nice. Well, I'm really happy that you decided to say yes to me, because I'm having a blast. I'm so happy you and I got connected. Definitely love it. What's a piece of advice that you would give somebody who says, you know, I want to be a police officer, whether it's in New York City, in Texas, in Wyoming, wherever it is, LAPD, wherever it is, what's one piece of advice that you would give somebody who is looking to go into law enforcement?
A couple.
Great. Let's go for it.
From the minute you're contacted, you know, to begin the process to get hired, for the first 2 years of your career, keep your mouth shut and your ears open.
Mm.
In law enforcement, nobody likes to know it all. Nobody likes someone that pushes back on things. You'll get your time. Just be humble. Listen. You're going to figure things out. You know, when you go to an NYPD precinct after field training, right? So you get dumped off in a precinct and there's 150 or 200 cops. It's almost like going to prison. You don't know who anybody is. Mm. People are coming up to you being nice. And then you find out, yeah, that's the guy that burns through partners because he's a dirtbag. Or this is the guy that's always hitting somebody up for money. So just listen, evaluate things. And after about 2 years, you're going to start figuring out. We used to call it the terrible twos because up until two, most rookie cops know how to get themselves in trouble. They don't know how to get themselves out of it. So ears open, mouth shut, and just, you know, try to look at things through other people's lenses. I used to see that like with a lot of cops, and unfortunately, some of them that lived in upstate, I'm not saying all of them, but a fraction of guys that came from like Long Island or something, they didn't grow up in the city. They didn't know how to deal with city people.
Mm-hmm.
They're very dismissive. And I'd say, well, just listen to him. Just, he might not say it as eloquently as you, but just listen to what this guy's got to say. You know what I mean? Right. Don't be dismissive.
Mm. Yeah. I think that it's changed a little bit, right? That now they, and I think it would make sense for the police departments in all areas to hire within their community, right? Wouldn't that make more sense?
Yes and no. I definitely see the advantages of it, but I worked with a lot of guys and girls from Westchester and Rockland and Orange County that were, crack shot detectives and investigators. Mm. I get what you're saying. Like I was a Bronx kid. You know what I mean? It wasn't the learning curve of dealing with people in a large city. I was already in it. To say a kid that comes from Orange, the other end of Orange County, in a town that's got 1,200 people, you know, back then. Now Orange County's kind of exploded in population, but it's yes, I definitely see the advantages of it, but I wouldn't dismiss hiring people from outside because they bring a totally different skill set.
Right. Different perspective. I get it. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. This has been a lot of fun, my friend. I know that you're going to come on my other show and we're going to do a great tip for people. So I definitely appreciate you being here today. And what can I say? Everybody who wants to find your book, the best place is what? Amazon?
Yeah, just go in the Amazon book section and type in my name, Vic Ferrari, like the car, and all my books will pop up. They're $10 paperback and $2.99 ebook download.
Oh, can't beat that. Awesome. And they should get them all, right?
They should get them all. They're funny. I mean, if you read one, chances are you're going to order the others. And if they want to get a hold of me on social media, they got a question or whatever, I'm at VicFerrari50 on Amazon and Instagram.
Nice. Beautiful. All right, my friend. Thank you. Have an amazing, amazing rest of your day.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. This was fun. We're going to have to do it again at another time. By the way, I am inviting you back to New York for July 13th through the 16th. I'm having a big event here. I'd love, as an author, as a speaker, I'd love for you to come.
Well, we'll talk.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Everybody, have an amazing day. Take care.
Thank you.